here about to start. So I'm going to introduce Dr. Mercelli, who is an expert in hypertension. He's a member of many committees. He belongs to the American Society of Hypertension, one of the founders. He's a member of the GMC committee, and he runs the hypertension clinic at San Luis right now.
Okay.
So welcome,
Dr. Thank you very much. Now, let me see how that goes. Let me see. Okay, conflict of interest. Can we turn this light off here that we have some... Or is this the best it gets? Yeah, okay, this is a little bit better. Conflict of interest statement here. And allow me to remind you that in the past 100 years, only during the 1918 flu pandemic was cardiovascular disease not the number one cause of death. So it's not going to get away. This is reassuring for those among us in cardiology, perhaps less reassuring for the general public. What is the residual lifetime risk of becoming hypertensive in a normotensive person age 55? In other words, you made it to 55, your blood pressure is still below 140 over 90. What are your odds of becoming hypertensive? 10 to 30, 30 to 50, 50 to 70, 70 to 90, over 90%. Anybody? Line is actually over 90%. As you can see, this is actually Framingham. So, 9 out of 10 people in this audience will ultimately pop some pills. So you better pay attention to what I'm saying here. Allow me to show you a first this. This is mortality in the U.S. white population, and as you can see here, after age 55 or so, obviously people start to die off some. Now, when you move to Bangladesh, not surprisingly, that looks a little bit different. You know, obviously people die earlier here, but what is surprising to us is that when you move to Harlem, and we are right here or very close, then this is what it looks. And this is New England Journal of Medicine, okay? Harlem is actually worse than Bangladesh. Now you're going to tell me, come on, this is just obviously, crack, AIDS and so on. Not necessarily so. You can see here, this is black, non-Hispanic population, cause of death. It's basically heart disease. Same situation. So there are pockets in the United States where mortality and morbidity is not much different than in Bangladesh. Allow me to show you a historical case. This is or was a gentleman who in the year 1935 was perfectly normotensive, blood pressure 140 over 70. In the following years, mild hypertension, 1941, a blood pressure of 170 over 100 was measured. No blood pressure BT 41, 44, but 1944, quite severe hypertension, 240 over 140 in the fall. Finally, April 1945, a blood pressure of above 300, systolic and 190 diastolic was recorded. The patient we're discussing right here is Franklin D. Roosevelt, who you see sitting between Winston Churchill and Joseph Stalin. Now, as most of you recognize, of course, this is a historical photograph of the Yalta Conference. I'd like to remind you that right here at Yalta, shortly after the November elections, FDR's blood pressure was in that 240 over 140 range. Now, the rest is history. As you may remember, the president was returning to the state shortly thereafter, went for recovery from his trip to a little resort in Georgia called Warm Springs. And according to the New York Times, on April 12th, he was complaining about a terrific headache, lost consciousness shortly thereafter, and as I said, a blood pressure of above 300 systolic, 190 diastolic was recorded, and the president was pronounced dead a few hours later. Now, what is amazing when you continue to read this article in the Times is the statement of his personal physician, Admiral Ross McIntyre, who asserted it came out of the clear sky. No indication of... McIntyre was an ear, nose, and throat physician. This may explain some. But nevertheless, even the Speaker of the White House, whose name was Early, said just before the trip, the president was given a thorough examination by 7 or 8 physicians, including some of the most eminent in the country, and pronounced organically sound in every way. which would mean that as late as 1945, hypertension was not considered a disease entity of any clinical consequences. Just to give you a physician's attitude toward hypertension at that time, allow me to quote one other eminent physician, personal physician of several presidents, who stated here, "Treatment of the hypertension itself is a difficult, almost hopeless task in the present state of our knowledge, and in fact, for aught we know, the hypertension may be a compensatory mechanism, which should not be tampered with even were it certain that we could control it." Paul Dudley White of Harvard, the founder of the American Heart Association, in his first edition, Heart Disease, 1931. And this is where that term essential hypertension is coming from. Hypertension is essential, it's compensatory. It serves to force blood through the sclerotic arteries to the target organs, therefore should not be tampered with, even though it's certain that we could do so. In the case of Roosevelt, not everything was caused by hypertension. As you can see, he still was smoking with a blood pressure of 240 over 140. And you don't need to be a doctor in order to diagnose that he was not in good health. Cheeks have fallen in, bags under his eyes. In fact, when you read the memoirs of Churchill, Sir Winston was complaining about the fact that FDR was napping, falling asleep, while negotiating with Stalin. And of course, Stalin, as an old fox, shamelessly abused his somnolence, prolonging all the meetings late into the night, so most important decisions were made at midnight when FDR was soundly snoring. What were the political consequences of this cat-and-mouse game? Very eloquently analyzed here by Professor Hart, speaking about the deadly hiatus in the American leadership, leading to Yalta, Potsdam, betrayal of the Poles, imposition of the communist governments in Eastern Europe, Czechoslovakia, and on the other side of the world, the loss of China, the invasion of South Korea. This much for complications of essential hypertension. Well, such was the state of the art in 1945. Today, some 60 years later, state of the art, or the new four-letter word, is evidence-based medicine, which is defined by Sackett as the conscientious, explicit, and judicious use of the best current clinical research evidence. Allow me, though, to contrast evidence-based medicine with eminence-based medicine, consisting in solemnly wagging a gray beard while making the same mistakes with increasing confidence over an impressive number of years. Let's look at the evidence of hypertension. I don't want you to see this slide, obviously, but these are the multi-million dollar, multi-center prospective randomized trials in hypertension, which ultimately should tell us which drugs are safe and efficacious, which ones are not. Allow me to mention one or two. Cysteure, the last placebo-controlled trial in hypertension, it's no longer ethical to do so, stopped prematurely because of a 42% reduction in the stroke rate in the active treatment group against placebo. Cysteure, thorough, prospective, randomized, double-blind, calcium blocker against placebo, more than 4,000 elderly patients with isolated systolic hypertension. Special attention, therefore, should be paid to the elderly. Pretty obvious to most of us who are in medicine these days. But then look at our sins from the past. For instance, antihypertensive agent produced no obvious benefits in patients over 65. Lancet 74. Or this. Diastolics up to 120 in symptomless elderly are not an indication for therapy. Modern geriatrics. How modern can you get? I gave grand rounds at the Brigham just about 3 months ago in April. And this is from Dr. Brown, Martin Harrison's. Systolic hypertension in the presence of a normal or reduced diastolic is rarely considered responsible for target organ damage. Absolutely terrible. Of course, terrible by today's standards. Clearly, a study like the Cysteure does away with this. Remember, this was only systolic hypertension, diastolic 80 or below. Yet, all endpoints reduced by 32, stroke by 42, cardiac by 26. Based on this study, the Joint National Committee labeled long-acting dihydropyridines as an appropriate alternative in these patients being the elderly. Now, I was part of this shall we say, venerable committees over many others, and it's therefore a consensus document, and we should not forget that consensus very often means that lots of people say collectively but nobody believes individually, which is probably true here as well. Okay, allow me to ask you a question. This is Laura Kay, 76 years old, suffered long-standing but well-controlled hypertension, dies last week of an acute MI. And my question to you is very simply, hypertension most likely has been treated, it could be a board question, treated with an ACE inhibitor, calcium antagonist, beta-blocker, diuretic, and ARB. In other words, for which one of these drug classes do we have data clearly showing no primary cardioprotective effect whatsoever, despite the fact that the patient's normal tensive, 130 over 70, the drug class has never shown to reduce the occurrence of a heart attack? Please make your choice. I'll give you an answer after just a few slides. Of all the therapies currently available for the prevention of sudden cardiac death, none is more established, more effective than the beta blockers. Annals of Internal Medicine, 1995, September 1st. I remember I read this statement and kind of thought a little bit about it, and when you look at all post-MI and so on, beta blockers are well established to prevent sudden cardiac death. Exactly 1 month later, now October 1st, same annals, diuretics, beta blockers as the risk for sudden cardiac death in hypertensive patients, and the conclusions of this paper were that the use of beta blockers is associated with an increased risk of sudden death compared with other antihypertensive medications. Now, ladies and gentlemen, these are the Annals of Internal Medicine, primary medical journal in the U.S., two completely contradictory statements 1 month apart. No wonder practicing physicians are getting a little bit confused. Well, in order to shed some light on this confusion, we did a study that subsequently was published in JAMA. We asked a very simple question. Are beta blockers efficacious as first-line therapy for hypertension in the elderly? And in order to look at this, we included all the randomized trials lasting at least a year, which used either a diuretic and or a beta blocker, reported morbidity and mortality. Simple, straightforward. But surprise, surprise. All-cause mortality, nice reduction with the diuretics, absolutely no effects with the beta blockers. Now you're going to say, come on, all-cause mortality includes car accidents, suicides, cancers, we need to look at the heart. Coronary heart disease, reduction with the diuretic, no effects with the beta blockers. Same holds true for overall cardiovascular disease. So our conclusion, until proven otherwise, beta blockers should no longer be considered appropriate as first-line therapy in uncomplicated hypertension in the elderly, which gives you the answer to my question. It's to be the blockers. You can debate the ACE inhibitors, calcium antagonists, the ARBs. You can no longer debate the beta blockers and the diuretics. The jury is in. We will have no other studies. Diuretics are, beta blockers are not primarily cardioprotective in hypertension. Now, are we the only guys stating this? This is a group well known to like beta blockers and diuretics, coming to the same conclusion. Despite lowering blood pressure, beta blockers failed to prevent coronary heart disease. Some of you may have seen the meta-analysis on atenolol in hypertension in the Lancet. This is atenolol versus placebo. Almost 7,000 patients. Well, atenolol is placebo. It does not reduce all-cause mortality, cardiovascular mortality, MI, or stroke. And finally, the most objective evidence, the Cochrane review, coming after a meta-analysis, also to conclusion that beta blockers should not be first line. Look at this. This is total mortality, effects of beta blockers, absolutely zero.